Sure that he needs no introduction in this particular audience, so I just stop at that point and invite Francisco to address us, please. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this meeting for actually putting it together. It's rare that one has the opportunity to have a concentrated discussion on this topic. And it is certainly a pleasure to be here in Ireland. I would like today to, in view of the kinds of interest gathering people here, to develop a bit of an argument, I suppose, for ideas that I've been trying to clarify in my own mind. So this is also for me sort of work in progress. That I reflected in the title, the question of intentionality as being at the core of the debate today in the so-called cognitive sciences, in ways that to me are still to be fully drawn out. I think that it is quite interesting to see autopoiesis at that light, which is not the usual way in which it can be discussed. So this is a little bit what I would like to do. Now, since the argument is not exactly linear, if you will allow me, for most of my presentation, I'm going to actually read from a text, which is a text that you get, so you don't have to scribble notes. It's not my habitual pattern. I rather like to speak spontaneously, but you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. So excuse me if that makes it a little slower or less theatrical than it might have been. Now, as Barry has just pointed out, these ideas as you all know, were first presented some now 15 years ago by Umberto Maturana and myself. And since then, in 1971, when we first wrote about those notions, quite a bit has happened. Now, let me just backtrack for a moment to begin at the very beginning. And although for most of you this will be well known, just for the sake of clarity, let me repeat what some of those basic ideas were and where it will move on. The basic inspiration for the notion of autopoiesis was to see that one could consider the bacterial cell as the simplest of all living systems because it contained a circular logic that is quite unique. And that circular logic is that it possesses the capacity to produce through a network of chemical processes all the chemical components which lead to the constitution of a distinct bounded unit. So, to avoid being trivial, the attribute living that can be applied to bacteria must address the process of that constitution and not the materiality that go into it. Now, the description of the living process has to be situated at a very specific level. And actually, Schrodinger is quite interesting, but when you read him, I think that that's exactly what he misses, the argument that most physicists do. Because it must be sufficiently universal to allow us to recognize living systems as a class, without a central reference to the material components, yet at the same time, it cannot be too abstract. So that is, it must be explicit enough to allow us to see such dynamical patterns in action in the actual living systems we know on Earth, or those potentially to be found elsewhere or created by man. So, recently, as you know, there has been an explosion of the so-called artificial life movement, particularly in the United States, partly in Europe, and Chris Lanton opened up the first edition of the Artificial Life volume by saying, quote, "Only when we are able to view life as we know it in the larger context of life as it could be, will we really understand the nature of the beast." That's basically quite in agreement with that position. Is the question of the level, which I think it's very important that we keep in mind. Now, our point of departure with Maturana was that, in fact, contemporary biology makes it possible to put forth the characterization of this living organization precisely at that very level. What you might say is a biologic. And we coined the word ontopoiesis to refer to that. And the definition was pretty much as follows. We said an ontopoietic system, which we understand as the minimum living organization, and the three words are key there, is one that continuously produces the components that specify it, while at the same time realizing the system as a concrete unity in space and time, which makes the network of production of components possible. So, if you want more extendedly, you could say that an autobiotic system is organized, that is, defined as a unity, as a network of processes of production, synthesis and destruction, such that these components, one, continuously regenerate and realize the network that produces them, and two, constitute the system as a distinguishable unit in the domain in which these components exist. These molecules is the molecular space. Now, I must say that I've been, if you want, turning around in my mind these ideas for some years, and there's many things that have changed, and some of them have remained more stable. But the one point which I think is key to relate this idea of autopoiesis to intentionality and perception is to really put the emphasis that what we are addressing here is that autopoiesis captures or attempts to capture the mechanism or process that generates the identity of the living. The word identity is quite crucial. That is, the identity which amounts to a self-produced coherence. The autopoietic mechanism will maintain itself as a distinct unit as long as this basic circular concatenation of processes is kept intact. And it will disappear when confronted with perturbations that go beyond a certain variable range. So obviously, and this is obvious because we started from there, all of the biochemical and membrane processes in cells can be immediately mapped onto these kinds of processes. Now, there's a whole different kind of exercise, which I'm not going to go into here, is to see how this basic autopoietic organization was present at the origin of terrestrial life. And in fact, it becomes progressively complexified through reproductive mechanisms, compartmentalization, sexual dimorphism, modes of nutrition, symbiosis, and so on and so forth. It is particularly pleasant to me that, in fact, this idea of autopoiesis has been used since, particularly by people like Lynn Margulis and others, to understand this process of the origin of life in historical terms, you know, from the Archean on. Why? Because again, it does give a handle for the identity of the living. Therefore, it does give you a criteria to identify the transition from non-living to living in historical terms, and to follow on this complexification process. I'm not going to do that, that's another story. Neither will I pursue an equally interesting, fascinating empirical question, which is, can a molecular structure simpler than the already complex bacterial cell satisfy the criteria of autopoietic organization? It's an empirical question. And this question can be answered by two complementary approaches. One is by simulation, and the other one is by construction, synthesis, chemical synthesis of such simple chemicals. Now, back in 1974, and this work has been extended substantially in more recent researchers in artificial life, the approach of simulations was already started, and the answer is a resounding yes. You can simulate, it seems to me, minimal autopoietic systems, and there is also the synthesis of chemical, minimal chemical autopoietic systems. This is a more recent development, and it is actually quite interesting. The whole new school of people, particularly headed by a man in Switzerland, Luigi Luisi, who actually have synthesized in the form of micellar, reverse micellar systems, what I would consider minimal autopoietic systems, and it's work that has been continued today. So that to me is quite fundamental that it's happened, because it makes this whole notion of autopoiesis a lot more, how can I say, cogent, a lot more based on some kind of empirical realm, which takes away some of the suspicion that it might just be a little flirt of imagination. So, be that as it may, that will be another workshop. So, let me come back to the more conceptual problem that, in fact, autopoiesis addresses, the issue of the organism as a minimal living system by characterizing, as I said, its basic mode of identity. Now, this is, philosophically speaking, to address the issue at an ontological level. The accent is on the manner in which a living system becomes a distinguishable entity, as we said, and not on specific molecular composition. In other words, the specificity of autopoiesis is to think of it self-referentially, that is, where the organization is the invariant. Now, this is actually, again, philosophically an interesting point, because the history of biology is, of course, fraught by the opposition between mechanist reductionist on one hand and holist vitalist on the other. And this is the heritage of the problem space, if you want, of the 19th century science, 19th century biology. I think that one of the specific contributions of the study of autopoiesis, or self-organizing mechanisms in general, but particularly autopoiesis, is that this traditional opposition between component elements and global properties completely disappears, because explicitly in this self-referential proposition we establish from the beginning a reciprocal causality. So there is no tension between the local, what the mechanism we call the local rules, and the emerging or global properties, which what the Holist would always refer to as the living quality. So it appears to me that this reciprocal causality does much to dispel this opposition, and it allows us to move into a much more constructive mode. So I take, and this is, if you want, a philosophical declaration, autopoiesis as a prime example of this dialectic between local components and the global properties which are linked together in explicit reciprocal relation. And there the word explicit is of course key. It's not enough to say it, you have to produce or provide the explicit links, which I think is, was one of the interesting things that happened in formulating this autopoiesis idea. So that was one point I wanted to raise as a, I think, interesting or important philosophical dimension of this debate. Now, a second and quite complementary dimension of this biologic that is quite important for me today is the nature of the relationship between the autopoietic unity and its environment. Now, it is by hypothesis quite evident that a system depends on its physicochemical milieu for its conservation. Otherwise, it would simply dissolve back into it. Now, once we have a very intriguing and an intriguing paradoxicality or paradox proper to this autonomous unit, which is this. The living system must distinguish itself from the environment while at the same time maintaining its coupling. Right? So this linkage cannot be detached since it is against this very environment from which the environment, from which the system arises. Okay? Now, in this coupling between the living unity or the minimal living unity and the physicochemical environment, what I would like to point out is that the balance, let me phrase it this way, the balance is slightly weighted towards the living unity, since it has this active role in itself production. It is in defining what it is as a unity that in that very same movement it defines what remains exterior to it, that is to say, its surrounding environment. So, what this examination makes it evident is that this exterior can only be characterized from the inside. Another way I like to formulate it is by saying the autopoietic unit creates a perspective from which the exterior or an exterior becomes one. So, this exterior cannot be confused with the physical surroundings as they appear to us as observers, as physicists, as chemists, because the laws of physics and chemistry per se are completely devoid of any kind of such perspective. So, in practice, when as biologists, well, as a biologist, if you are engineers, I'm not sure it's quite the same problem space, but as biologists, we actually switch constantly between these two domains because we use and manipulate physicochemical principles and properties, while at the same time shifting to the use of the interpretation and the significance as seen from the point of view of the living system. So, for example, a bacteria swimming in a sucrose gradient is quite conveniently analyzed in terms of the local effects of sucrose on membrane permeability, medium viscosity, hydromechanics of the flagellar bead, and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, the sucrose gradient and flagellar bead are interesting to analyze only because the entire bacteria points to such items such as gradient as being relevant. So the specific significance in its feeding behavior is only possible by the presence and the perspective of the bacteria as a totality. So if you remove the bacteria as a unit, right, and all the correlations between gradients and hydrodynamic properties become physical and chemical laws, evident to us as observers, but are completely devoid of any special significance. Now, I've gone into this perhaps lengthy analysis because I think that this is truly a key point. It may appear so obvious that we don't appreciate the deep ramifications that this simple observation has. And I mean the important distinction between the environment of the living system, as it appears to us as an observer, without reference to the autonomous system, which I will call hereinafter the environment, and the environment for the system, which is defined in the same movement that gives rise to the identity, and that only exists in that mutual definition, which is what I will call hereinafter the system's world. There's a difference between environment and its world. Now, the difference between environment and world is that surplus of signification which haunts the understanding of the living and of cognition altogether, and which is at the root of what the end of cognitive science altogether today. In other words, the surplus is the mother of intentionality. If you want to, that's a bit of a formulaic statement of my presentation today, that it is in the movement of distinction between world and environment that you have the mother fountain of intentionality, the surplus as the mother of intentionality. Now, it is quite difficult in practice to keep in view this dialectics of this mutual definition. Neither it is a rigid isolation, nor simple continuity with physical chemistry. It is quite easy to conflate the units of the system's world with its environment, since it is so obvious that we're studying that molecular interaction of this chemical gradient in the context of an autonomous cellular unit, and hence to miss that surplus added by the organism perspective. So again, to repeat, there is no food significance in sucrose except when a bacteria swims upgrading and its metabolism uses a molecule in a way that allows the bacteria to continue its own identity. This surplus is obviously not indifferent to the regularities and the textures, the laws, if you want, that operate in the environment, that sucrose can create a gradient and traverse the cell membrane and so forth. On the contrary, the system world is built on those regularities, which is what assures that it can maintain its toughness at all times. So, what the autopoietic system does, due to its very mode of identity then, is to constantly confront the encounters, perturbations, the shocks, the coupling with its environments and treat them from a perspective which is not intrinsic to the encounters themselves. Rocks or crystal beads or aggregates of salt don't beckon sugar gradients out of the infinite possibilities of physical-chemical interactions as particularly meaningful. For this to happen, a perspective from an actively constituted identity is essential. So it is tempting at this point, of course, and I've been accused many times of this, to slide into some sort of vaporous cloud about meaning, reminiscent of the worst kind of vitalism, or of the past, or the informational jargon of contemporary time. What I emphasize here is much simpler. It's simply that what is meaningful for an organism is precisely given by its constitution as a distributed process, with an indissociable link between local processes where the interaction can occur, that is, physical-chemical forces acting on a cell, and the coordinated entity, which is the autopoietic unit, giving rise to that handling of the environment without having to resort to some external agent that provides the information or provides the enough, the tag. Now, I'm tempted also to rephrase this very same idea slightly by sort of shifting it upside down, so to speak, and say this, that this constant bringing forth of signification is what we describe as a permanent lack in the living. Why? Because it is constantly bringing forth a signification that is missing, that is not pre-given or pre-existent. Relevance must be provided out of nothing, ex nihilo. You distinguish between relevant from irrelevant molecular species, follow a gradient uphill and not downhill, or increase the permeability of this ion and not to that one, and so on. So that there is this inevitable contretemps between an autonomous system and its environment. There is always something which the system must furnish from its perspective as a functioning whole. So a molecular encounter acquires significance in the context of the entire operating system. And the source for this significance making, or this world making, to use that beautiful title from Nelson Woodman's book, Ways of World Making, is always the breakdowns, and this is what I mean by the lack, is always the breakdowns in autopoiesis. Autopoiesis was a steady process without any chance of stopping. Then there would be no signification. What is significant is, in fact, that this world making arises in the breaks, in the breakdowns, whether they be little ones, like changes in concentration of the metabolite, or major disruptions of the boundary. Because of the self-referential nature of autopoiesis, say, when you have membrane repair in cell, every breakdown can be seen as the initiation of an action on what is missing on the part of the system so that identity can be maintained. So there is no teleology implied in that, so that identity can be maintained. That's what the self-referential logic of autopoiesis entails in the first place. The action taken will be visible in an attempt to modify its world, change from place to different natures, increase the flow of metabolites and so forth and so on. So, in brief, this permanent, relentless action on what is lacking becomes, from the observer's point of view, the ongoing cognitive activity of the system, which is the basis for the incommensurable difference between the environment in which the system is observed and the world within which the system operates. Now, one of the, I think, important interesting things about this view of intentionality or cognitive activity is that this cognitive activity, seen from this point of view, is paradoxical at its very root, and I insist on this paradoxical quality. On the one hand, the action that brings forth the world is an attempt to re-establish a coupling with an environment because it's defied the internal coherence in an encounter. But such actions at the same time demarcate and separate the system from the environment because it gives rise to a distinct world. So there is an intrinsic paradoxality that the lack both re-establishes contact and at the same time demarcates the system. Some of you have seen this happen before, although this is happening less and less after the great expansion of the artificial life community. Disagree with the use of cognitive or intentional for such simpler cellular systems, but I really fundamentally agree with the A-Life community that we gain much by seeing the continuity between the fundamental form of self, fundamental form of identity, and up to the neural, the linguistic, and so-called higher cognitive abilities, where, of course, the question of cognition is unproblematic. Others, I suppose, would prefer here to introduce the word information. Now, let me just say a word why I think that this is problematic. Although it is clear that we always describe a certain X, something that perturbs the organism, this perturbing agent, this X, is not information, because for the organism it's just a that, a something, a basic stuff to inform, as I said, from its own perspective. But in physical terms, there is stuff, it is for nobody. But once there is a unit, self, or a minimal form of a body, it becomes informed for that self. So such information is never signification or bits or something that is waiting there to be harvested. It is an occasion for coupling, and it is where it arises. So the term cognitive, just to rephrase that paradoxicality, has two constitutive dimensions. First, it is the coupling dimension, that is, a link with the environment allowing for its continuity as a unit. And otherwise, we have no self. The second is what I would like to call its imaginary dimension, that is, the surplus of significance that the physical interaction acquires due to the perspective provided by the action of the articulated system. So you have the coupling and the imaginary dimension, which both of them have, as I pointed out before, that a bit of that paradoxical tension, because they seem to go opposite to each other, and yet, because of the self-referential logic, actually they create what is, to me, as I said, the mother of intentionality. Now, are you lost? Ça va? I'm sorry, as I said, I just repeat something I said right at the beginning. I wanted to develop an argument, because as I hope towards the end we'll come back to it. There's much discussion today, as you all know, about intentionality. There's arguments, you know, for and against. There is a bit of a sense of crisis in the Kokusai community. The dominance of the symbol processing, or cognitivist or computationalist ideas of the 1960s and 70s clearly are not dominant anymore, and, you know, there are, Rod Brooks talks about the nouvelle AI, and Steve Harner talks about the symbol grounding problem, and John Searle talks about the syntax grounding problem, and others speak about situated agents and emerging functionality. There's a number of levels in the current literature, be this from neuroscience, from AI, or from life, which make it very clear that we're coming back to something that I'm very happy we're coming back, throwing open this question of the sense and the origin of intentionality. And my argument is that autopoiesis actually provides sort of the point of entry to an answer to this question of intentionality by grounding it on basic biology. And the hinge for this grounding, the landing point of this entry point, is this distinction between environment and world, this paradoxical but non-antinomic nature between coupling and imaginary dimension, which is why I think one has to really chew on it, although it might seem either completely nonsense or completely simple, it has, I believe, the potential to give us a way to look at intentionality in a light which I believe, as I will come back to that at the end, dispels to a large extent these apparent paradoxes that are being discussed in various people like Benedict or Searle and so forth. Now, in order for me to do that, I'm going to use the rest of the time that I have to try to argue just, you know, on rather fundamental terms, how this basic grounding on intentionality in out-of-oriented systems and this kind of mechanism of the creation of the surplus signification can, in fact, be extended into more traditional perceptual systems, that is, systems that contain some kind of neural system. So my strategy is that I have presented or sketched the interlock between identity and cognition as it appeared from the minimal organism. And what I would like to do now briefly is to show how the more traditional levels of cognitive properties from brains, multicellular animals, is in some very important sense the continuation of the very same process, which is why I refer to this idea of basic autopoietic intentionality as the entry point. It's not a regional phenomenon, but it actually extends up. Now, in order to see this shift from minimal autopoietic systems to more traditional cognitive properties, contrary to many other ways of discussing this problem, I think the key here is to understand the shift from minimal cellular organisms to multicellular organisms. You see, I've insisted that the key in the creation of the imaginary dimension is the constitution of a self through self-constitution of body, minimal body. Equally, when you move from multicellular organisms, the key is to understand the nature of the constitution of this body as such. Now, normally we start immediately talking about the retina and the sense organs and the brain and the visual cortex and whatnot, and we tend to forget, because of course when you push people, they say, no, I haven't forgotten it, that all of that exists within the body. But I claim that in modern biology, in fact, we don't really have a clear grasp of what is the body, paradoxical as that might seem. How do you put together a whole bunch of cells to create a commonality which constitutes an identity without one lineage of self, for example, taking over, or without having all cells behaving as if they didn't belong to a common organism? The nature of this somatic coherence is far from being clear, and it's much less clear in modern biology than the coherence of a cellular unit, which is why autopoiesis, if you want, is simple to say, easy. Once you ask a question, it's easy. There is no simple equivalent answer to the coherence of a multicellular body. Simply, we don't have enough of the biology for that, because the transition from multicellular to, from unicellular to multicellular is quite a quandary. And for example, there's a beautiful book by an American biologist called Leo Buss recently, called The Ontogeny of Individuality, where he says the following, quote, "The evolution of development is the generation of a somatic ecology, like his term, that mediates potential conflict between self and the individual, while the organism is simultaneously interacting effectively with the extrasomatic environment. You see what he's saying there? He's saying you have a whole bunch of lineages of cells in your own body. All of these have to compete and cooperate to create coherent somatic ecology. While at the same time, this organism, because it's now the global emerging unity, is interacting with an extrasomatic environment. So the nature of this process that can be expressed clearly for the cell cannot yet be expressed clearly about the somatic ecology. Let me give you one example of this. One of the ways in which the somatic ecology actually happens is through a network that binds cells together, and that is the network of immune processes. Contrary to received views, which I cannot, again, that will be another seminar that I would love to go into, but we don't have time. Immune systems are not fundamentally defensive systems. Of course, a defensive property, but that's quite secondary. The primary property is that they function like links that mediate between molecular, macromolecular profiles within the body and create a sort of a commonality of language between distant molecular profiles on cells and on circulating hormones and whatnot. The immune network, as a network, much like the brain, is the source, much of the source, for this somatic coherence. Yet, this notion of a somatic network embedded or embodied in the immune system is only just beginning to be explored in the last 4 or 5 years. It is an area in which I'm currently working most of my time, and I'm quite fascinated by it. But again, and that is another diversion. What I wanted to do, at least, is to bring here the issue or the question that when we talk about the place of the nervous system in this process of cognition, we have to understand that it is the nervous system within, as a lineage of cells, within this self-produced coherence of the organism, for which we have not yet the equivalent outweighed deep processes. So there's a big question mark there that we need to understand as a question mark. In any case, be that as it may, within that area of ignorance, what we do know is that the nervous system plays within the somatic ecology a fundamental role when it comes to movement, when it comes to motion of this somatic ecology, of this coherence of the multicellular organism. Because there is a clear correspondence between motion and the development of the nervous system, because the emotion, the key, the basic neural logic, not just now the biologic, but the neural logic here, as I have said several times, particularly in our book, The Tree of Knowledge, is the coupling between movement with a stream of sensory modulation in a circular process. So the net result of what the nervous system does is the correlations between perception and action from the modulated by the intervening neurons, the interneuron network. So the neurons are unique among the cells of a multicellular organism in that their long ramifications permit the contact between sensory and motor processes to establish these correlations, much like the immune system through the flotation and diffusion of lymphocytes and antibodies permits the linking between otherwise distant profiles. So we're beginning to see here the origins of a somatic coherence, but the nervous system plays a key role when it comes to motion. Now, contrary to what sometimes is done, I emphasize from the very start here, therefore, the situatedness of this neural logic. The state of activity of sensors is brought about most typically, by the organism's own action. To an important extent, then, behavior is the regulation of perception. Of course, this does not exclude independent perturbations from an environment, but what is typically described as a stimulus in the laboratory is something which is classically deliberately independent of the animal's ongoing activity, and that is by far less significant when one examines the life, the sensory model life of an ecologically situated organism. So in that sense, neuroscience has biased our understanding of sensory processes as some kind of passive deception. Now, I think that most people are waking up to that fact, hopefully. In the neuroscience, that is certainly the case. I also have the impression that in robotics, for example, this new way of robotics work also has beginning to size up to the importance of self-propelled, self-regulated perceptual operation. Anyway, the perceptual motor coherences we describe externally as behavior, because that's what behavior is the coherence of sensory motor acts. We have disguise as it is obviously the arising within the interneural net of an enormous subset or an ensemble, as it is said sometimes, of transiently correlated neurons. And these ensembles are both the source and the result from the activity of sensory and effector surfaces. So what changes from one nervous system to another is the amount and the kinds of mediating interneurons and the specific architecture of this nervous system, which contain various regions, cortical areas, layers, nuclei, and so forth. As you perhaps know, in humans, we have about 10 to 11 interneurons, which interconnect some 10 to 6 motor neurons and 10 to the 7 sensory neurons, so you have a ratio of 10 to 100,000 to 1 of interneurons mediating this coupling of sensory and motor surfaces. Now, whether, for example, if you take recent work on the behavior of aplasia, where people can monitor with optical devices the ongoing activity of the entire nervous system in some ongoing behavior of aplasia, say, so-called siphon withdrawal. Aplasia is this little slug. When it sort of comes across an edge, usually the siphon is retracted. Now, this simple gesture, this micro-action of the siphon, takes into activity just about more than half of the entire nervous system of aplasia, which is quite a remarkable thing. And similarly, in studying the cat four years ago, John and collaborators in New York found that when a cat simply presses on a spot on the ground, the lever, you have about 100 million neurons participating in that gesture, which is just, mind-boggling to think about it. So the idea that you can explain this phenomena in the terms that I was grew up with, by going through pathways and circuits, is certainly not quite the case. But this neuronal dynamics underlying a perceptual motor task is clearly a highly cooperative network affair, and not a stage by stage information.